Welcome to the Hirschfeld Century Podcast. I'm Catherine Eastman, the Archives Manager at the Al Hirschfeld Foundation.
And I'm David Leopold, the Creative Director.
And we are back today with our newest online exhibition that is titled Hirschfeld's New Season.
The Herald of Things to Come.
Yes. Why don't you tell us, what does Hirschfeld's New Season even mean, David?
Well, I thought this was an interesting time to do a show like this. Everything's opening back up. We're having a new season this year that we did not have last year. And whether it's in the theater or in the movies or concert halls or even museums, you know, we've got a real new season and things are happening. And I thought, what a better time. There wouldn't be a better time to celebrate new seasons than now.
Right.
I hope we never have to go through as long of a period of not having a new season. So I thought, well, Hirschfeld, I grew up seeing these new season drawings that Hirschfeld did in the late 70s and 80s. And I thought to myself, when did he start doing this? And did he do it just for theater? And one of the great pleasures, as you know, is in researching, is looking through thousands of drawings to look for what you're trying to find.
Right.
And
well, and also to look for like the beginning of something that become kind of a Hirschfeld staple or not a trademark, but something he would do a lot. When did he first start doing that?
Exactly. So when I started with this one, I didn't know when it was. Maybe it was just a 70s thing.
I would, if you asked me, I would guess the 60s. Maybe.
Yeah. I mean, I could see all these composites of Academy Award nominees or Tony nominees. That's actually fairly common, and he did that a lot.
Right.
It's much different when he's talking about a number of shows that are about ready to open, the things that haven't happened yet, that even he hasn't seen yet. So he's really, what was he working from? How was he doing it? We don't know those answers. And it's not entirely important because the important thing is the drawing at the end of the process. But I just thought, let's go back and take a look. And I was very surprised to find that the first sort of new season drawing that he did was 90 years ago.
Wow.
And that was in 1931. It was headlined Five Thespians Due on Broadway. And what is so remarkable about the drawing is it's four different shows, and he integrates the characters. So they're individual drawings, but they all fit together as a whole. You know, it would become a hallmark of his, but this is really one of the first times that he did it. I love that Sylvia Field figure in the center of the drawing, how he makes it all work. And then it also gives him sort of not a halo, but it makes you focus on Jack Haley and the rabbit.
Yeah. I think every Jack Haley drawing kind of looks, he kind of has this signature look.
That's how Jack Haley looks.
At least in Hirschfeld drawings, he's always kind of, he's got this deer in the headlights, but he's very excited. It's manic almost. He's got this kind of manic face about him.
I believe that was his act. You know, what you see in The Wizard of Oz, which is, of course, the touchstone for anybody.
Right. That's how I know Jack Haley.
I'm sure anybody who knows Jack Haley, the number of people who saw Jack Haley perform on stage is actually quite small.
Right.
And so it's only the films. But I know that I remember when I was working on a project on Irving Berlin, I watched the 1938 film Alexander's Ragtime Band, and Jack Haley's in that. And he looks exactly the same. This deer in the headlights, excited, kind of manic, a little sort of klutzy.
I feel like Hirschfeld could almost have given him the spiral eyes.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And I mean, this is a fun drawing, and it's different kinds of drawings. The rabbi in the right hand corner that's a very different drawing than Harry Ellerby in the lower left corner.
He's very Rasputin-esque.
Very Rasputin-esque. Very. Although the show itself was not that at all. Then, of course, looking at a Hirschfeld drawing from 1931 to me, I'm off to the races. I want to know, hey, were these shows any good?
And spoiler alert, I'm going to say no.
Certainly the public at that time did not think they were any good. The longest run of any of these shows is 2 weeks. And that's in the first drawing, when you start in the clock, you know, at the top left, and you go clockwise, you have Paul Kelly and Sylvia Field in mm-hmm. Just to Remind You. Just to remind you to see this show because we're closing soon. Paul Kelly would eventually win a Tony 20 years later. You didn't grow up with it, but I grew up in seeing Dennis the Menace in syndication. And it turned out Sylvia Field was Mrs. Wilson,
right,
the next door neighbor's wife. Boris Tomaszewski is unknown today, but he really helped introduce Yiddish theater to New York and really to America. And today we would know him as the grandfather of the conductor Michael Tilson Thomas. And I mean, there is a whole incredible range, starting with a rabbi singing in the Yiddish theater to a man composing and conducting some of the most modern music of the late 20th century and early 21st century. Really amazing. And when when Michael Tilson Thomas's name came up when I would be talking to Hirschfeld, he saw him as Boris Tomaszewski's grandson.
Oh, interesting.
You know, because he grew up with Boris Tomaszewski.
That's funny.
And of course, his great friend Boris Aronson was also very involved in Yiddish theater. So he knew a great deal about that. The Jack Haley Show is an Oscar Hammerstein show that I'm sure Rodgers and Hammerstein would not like you to remember. When I looked up the Times review, it was subtitled "Communism with Music," and "Free for All." It was, they were giving something out. I forget exactly what it was. It was a ridiculous plot, and I'm sure the songs were only mediocre, and no one ever heard of it again. You will not be seeing a revival of "Free for All" anytime soon.
Doubtful.
But all these actors would go on to have different careers. But in the 1931-1932 season, the best thing they got was a Hirschfeld drawing at the start of it. Now, what is also interesting is this is almost all of what we know of the Broadway season as seen by Hirschfeld. Because within a few weeks of this drawing appearing, he left the country.
Right.
He left the hemisphere.
Yeah.
You know, he went to Tahiti and then eventually to Bali.
Right.
And he spent most of 32 in Bali.
Gotcha.
So it's an interesting moment for Hirschfeld. This is a drawing you see just before he leaves.
Mm.
So for those of you with history on your mind, and this one's got a lot of it.
And when he came back, it would be a lot different.
A lot
different. His style, I mean.
A lot, very much different.
What's the next one we're going to talk about?
Well, I love all these. I wanted to talk about the Gilbert and Sullivan drawing titled "The Doily Cart Company Prepare to Offer a New Season of Gilbert and Sullivan." Now, the Doily Cart Opera Company, which is its full name, was the company that was the only professional company that was allowed to produce Gilbert and Sullivan. They had commissioned Gilbert and Sullivan to create the operettas in the first place. And they had been coming to America since the late 1800s. And they occasionally appeared on Broadway. But it was the 1930s that they really had a sustained presence on Broadway. They would come into the Martin Beck, which of course now is...
the Al Hirschfeld Theater.
Yes. I only think about that. If you could flash back for a moment, seeing Hirschfeld sitting in the Martin Beck.
He had no idea.
He had no idea. And it makes me also realize how many shows he saw there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because, you know, when he was told that the theater was going to be renamed for him, uncharacteristically, he was speechless.
No.
You know, he didn't even have a quick quip on mm-hmm. it, you know. Like when they called him to say that he was going to be a living landmark, the Landmarks Commission. Mm-hmm. He was going to be in the first group of living landmarks. I was in the studio and Brendan Gill called him and asked him this. And Al's first response was, "Does this mean I can't shower?" So he always had a quip,
right?
You know, and he was really dumbfounded.
Yeah.
This was really something special. And I think it's because he did spend a lot of time in there. I mean,
I was just thinking when I was rereading these captions earlier, what did he have a favorite Broadway theater? Was there like one he was like, "Oh, I just love to go to the Martin Beck," or I don't like the Schubert Theater.
I never heard him say that he had a favorite.
When I thought in my head, I was like, he doesn't pick favorites. So I can't imagine he would say something like that, but I thought I would ask.
And that's right. He was not a person who picked favorites because he liked everything and didn't want to hurt anybody's feelings. He didn't have a favorite Broadway theater that I knew about.
Right.
But sometimes when we would have to go see shows off Broadway, he would refer to them as the urinal theaters. Because they always smelled that way. Or they were in some third floor walk-up, you know, and you had to go out in the
hallway.
You don't
have a favorite, but you definitely have a few least favorite ones to go to.
He didn't make any sound like, oh, no, I have to go there.
Right.
That's just literally how he referred to them, the urinal theaters.
That's funny.
He loved Off-Broadway, you know, and really tried to get the Tonys to recognize Off-Broadway.
Good theater happens everywhere.
That is, I've heard it said. Well, so what I think is so amazing, and we have links to all of this in the exhibition. So Hirschfeld did several drawings like this where he showed all the different shows on different years that they were coming. And I think actually in 34, 36, and 39, he had a composite like this. And he might do that for one paper, but for the other papers, he would do individual productions. So when you follow the Gilbert and Sullivan link on the in the online exhibition, you're going to see a lot of different shows, and a lot of shows that were done at the same time as the one the drawing that you're seeing. So it's really kind of fun. And, of course, Gilbert and Sullivan are a great part of the theatrical tradition, both here and everywhere else. And again, he's taken a lot of disparate figures and brought them all together in a unified whole. The Mikado, the seated Mikado, really pulls things together, but it's not given any more or less emphasis, but it seems to sort of draw your eye
it's
to it.
It's the touchstone, yeah.
Yeah. And he's framed beautifully by the striped dress behind him. The next one I want to talk about is one that I'm sure Hirschfeld was at the opening of this show. William Saroyan opened season at Belasco. So that was, Saroyan had been, his first show on Broadway was in 1939. He'd been very successful. He had met Al right before that show opened and they became very good friends. And by 1942... Saroyan was tired with traditional Broadway producing. He decided, why do I need these guys? They're always telling me what I can't do. So he decided he was going to create his own company. He was going to present new plays every 2 weeks. And when I say he was going to create his own company, he would have great actors in there, but he would also get people off the streets. You know, to him, they were great actors.
Right.
It might be the guy selling newspapers outside the theater. He just thought that was a great performance and it should be in it. In this drawing, so he opened his season at the Belasco. And if you're wondering, gosh, I don't know any other shows in that season, because after 2 weeks when these shows closed, he never presented another production by the Saroyan Theater. And this was, and these plays are not done.
So this was not a hit.
This was not a hit. Gilbert and Sullivan hit.
Right.
You know? Right. But here's another instance where he's heralding a new season and the new season turns out to be not that long. What I think is fascinating about this drawing is I love the drawing of Canada Lee at the bottom. I mean, that's as iconic of an image of Canada Lee that you would see later in Native Son.
Yeah.
Those drawings. Actually, Native Son was the year before. But it's really a strong image and a very unusual but great Hirschfeld drawing. I looked in the audience of this because oftentimes Hirschfeld would put himself. He wouldn't have put Dolly in yet because they weren't married. I'm not sure if they were even dating at this time. But I couldn't recognize anybody.
David, I don't think they were dating, and I'm going to tell you why. Because this is from 1942.
Yes.
And that Chaplin article is also from 1942.
Yes.
And we know that when Hirschfeld went to to Dolly's, or did he go to her dressing room, or did somebody else go?
No, he went to her dressing
room. He went to her dressing room. She had a clipping of that Chaplin article on her mirror.
It's all true.
And so, and I don't think they were dating at that time.
No.
Correct?
Well,
she was still married. Was she still married?
She was not married. He was.
Oh, I thought she was, or she just had a boyfriend.
She had, no. She had been married to John Brahm.
Oh.
And they had split up and divorced.
Oh, okay. Because I thought someone said to Hirschfeld, I don't know, you'll have to ask her husband.
Right.
Oh, okay. That was before.
So this was, literally would have been weeks before this.
Okay.
He was at Sam Rafelson's house in Hollywood. He had been out there for 8 weeks. So June and July of 1942, Hirschfeld is in California.
Yeah. And July 26, 1942 is when that Chaplin piece was published.
Right.
I only know that because that is my, not the 1942 part, but July 26 is my wedding day. And I know that that was published on that day.
And she is also a genius with both feet in the clouds.
Yes. So anyway, he was not dating Dolly at this time.
No, exactly. He might have met her right around this time.
Right.
And so it's interesting. So there's nobody. Paul Lawrence is not in that crowd. Mm. And I don't see S.J. Perlman.
Mm-hmm.
Could there be people that are actually?
They seem fairly generic.
Right. That's what I think.
Looking at them.
But I'm sure somebody saw themselves in it.
I'm sure.
And I wouldn't be surprised if he intentionally put somebody in there. But this is just a wild piece altogether. So the next one I want to talk about, there's a lot of great drawings in the show, but the invading Hollywood personalities. As we know, there has always been a revolving door of performers from Broadway to Hollywood and back. And in 1957, there were a lot of actors who were primarily known for their stage roles coming to Broadway. And as you look at this group, that includes Carl Malden and Shelley Winters and Agnes Moorehead and Joan Blondell and Lena Horne and Ricardo Montalban and Robert Preston. It's a pretty incredible group. To look at this, they were coming into shows. Almost none of these shows were successes. Mm. But a few of them were legendary. Really, one was. Robert Preston, seen in the top center with the mustache, was coming back from Hollywood to perform in a musical about a con man who comes into a little town and sells them instruments.
Wild.
Called The Music Man. And that show, obviously, was popular enough. It's been revived several times on Broadway, including this season coming up.
Mm-hmm.
Who would have known from seeing this picture? He was just an invading Hollywood personality.
And I'm going to be honest, who would know from this picture that he's in The Music Man?
Right. These are not, they're not shown in their show clothes.
Right, right. Just kind of, here are the names coming.
Right.
These this are, is who you can look forward to seeing this year
and
or this season.
And you couldn't fault Hirschfeld for not getting them in their costumes.
No.
Some of these shows never opened.
Oh my goodness.
You know, Agnes Moorehead and Shelley Winters were in shows that did not make it to Broadway.
Mm.
And then other ones like Pat O'Brien and Carl Malden were in shows that lasted, I mean, they lasted a week or two.
Mm.
And although they had been on Broadway a number of times before this, they would never appear on Broadway again. Joan Blondell was coming to be in a show called Copper and Brass, whose star was Nancy Walker.
Right.
Hirschfeld actually did a poster for that show.
Right.
Did not help.
Mm.
Ran about 2 weeks.
He can't fix everything.
Yeah. Now, Lena Horne and Ricardo Montalban were in a musical, Jamaica, which was a hit.
Right.
It wasn't a Music Man-sized hit, but Hirschfeld did a great drawing and would later take the Lena Horne from that drawing and adapt it into a print, an etching in the 1980s. That's
beautiful.
Really quite wonderful. So I love this because this is just, again, it gets you sort of excited about the new season, and the people who are going to be in it, because for a lot of people, they never got beyond this drawing. You know,
right.
When you looked at those five thespians or Gilbert and Sullivan, most people were not going to see that show. Right. Even if they sold out every night, it was still going to be a relatively small portion.
And that's true throughout his career, I think, right, as well. More people saw the drawing than ever saw the shows.
Right. But by seeing the drawings, people were so interested in looking at the drawings, yeah, they got to know what was happening.
Yeah. You got a little piece of it.
You had a more informed, yes, population, right, I guess. We need someone like Hirschfeld to get people interested in what's happening all the time on Broadway. But we're going to jump to Broadway, to TV. In 1968...
My favorite place to be.
Yeah. What, that TV is your favorite place to be?
I think if I had a choice, yeah, I'm going to go with television. The reason being, you can tell a longer story. Sometimes that's a curse. I've watched shows where I'm like, this has gone on for way too long.
I have seen plays that have taken all day.
Mm, so, the Kentucky Cycle?
The Kentucky Cycle. Yeah. That was a classic. Pulitzer Prize winner. Mm. No one ever does it now. But in 1968, Hirschfeld did a drawing not for the New York Times, but for the Christian Science Monitor.
Oh, boy.
Which he had actually done drawings for off and on for years, mostly in the 40s. And here he's looking. I love the caption that he wrote on this drawing. Some of the new shows scheduled between commercials for this fall on your grown box. And I think it would be hard for you to understand. You didn't grow up in a world in which the new season of shows on television was like exciting. Like you had to spend all summer watching reruns. And
yeah, I didn't watch a lot of TV when I, yeah, no, you watched children's shows, right, which were, yeah.
But when I was growing up, the new season on television, that was a big deal. You know, there were, you know, they're going to unveil their new season and what's going to be on it and what are the good shows. And,
right,
and again, it was just because you only had three stations to look at.
Well, and it's also so new, too.
Yes.
Even in 1968, it's still very new. You know, home televisions are
not every very home has new. Yeah. I mean, and they're watching on black and white TVs, most people. Yeah. I mean, I know that in my house, we were still watching black and white TVs. But what I find very interesting about this drawing is it really has some fascinating contemporary connections.
A lot of cowboy hats.
That was big. You know, around this time, the Western or country folk. You know, CBS had a whole lineup around this time, built around the Beverly Hillbillies and Petticoat Junction. And
Rawhide.
Yeah, they had
that earlier.
Gunsmoke.
Mm-hmm.
And in a move that would never be done today, I think by the next year or two, they would cancel all those shows. Because they thought that it was making them look like sort of the Rube station.
Well, I was going to say, well, we've been to the moon, so we got to do Star Trek now. We can't be stuck in the dirt out here with our horse and buggies.
Oh, no, Star Trek had already been done, but it's weird. Because Beverly Hillbillies, I don't know, I still find that funny.
Yeah, it is funny.
And a lot of those shows, and the idea of canceling a show, even though it's successful and popular,
just because you're like, we can't. This isn't our brand anymore.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. Well, in 1968, Westerns were still very much part of the scene. In the lower right, there is sort of a TV Western version of Defiant Ones.
Mm.
You know, a black and white cowboy who are working together, even if they're not equals.
Mm.
And then up above is a show called Lancer.
Oh, yes.
That ran for two seasons. But, okay, still plays a role in our culture because I know you did see it, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Yes.
Incorporates a fictionalized account of the shooting of Lancer's first episode.
Hilarious. That's the best part of that movie, by the way.
We are now going to take time to critique Quentin Tarantino and his films.
That was watching them film Lancer. If you disagree, I think you need to watch it again because that was the best part. I was so invested in them shooting this episode.
Well, you know, they did a novelization of the film.
Right.
And they actually expand the Lancer section.
I bought that book for my husband. He read it. I did not read it.
Oh. Well, we could have had a reading.
You should have asked him.
Yeah, right. Wrong member of the household. There was also, there's Diane Carroll and a young boy in a show called Julia. This is, I mean, it's so hard to believe, but this is the first TV show that starred a black performer, a black woman, in a non-stereotypical role.
Right.
She's not a maid.
Mm.
She's not a, you know, domestic of any kind.
She's head of her household.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And it was actually forward thinking, but black people at the time who were really, there was a real sense of black power, you know, 1968, Black Panthers and all that, they kind of saw it as sort of almost Uncle Tom-ish, because she wasn't really representing all black people. The fact is, she was performing in a regular sitcom in which she happened to be black, rather than dealing with black issues. And I'm a big Gil Scott-Heron fan, and he has a classic song that a lot of people know called "The Revolution Will Not Be Televised," and he name checks her as something that you will not see when the revolution happens, because you know it was considered just very tame. The show that I've thought I should really try to track down and see more of is the one that Robert Morse, who you can see in the lower left, is in. This was an interesting series that was done in the form of a Broadway style musical. It's it's about the ups and downs of a young couple, but they were writing original songs. They were including standards and even pop hits. They had all kinds of stars on the show. I talk about Liza Minnelli and Sid Caesar, but they had a ton. Almost every episode had different stars. And, of course, Robert Morse had a big hit on Broadway 4 years earlier in How to Succeed in Business, and was generally seen as a star.
Is this show available anywhere?
I wouldn't be surprised if it's on YouTube, or you can see some of it on YouTube. But it's weird that a show like this, which sounds so interesting, failed to capture audiences.
Interesting.
But I think that may be also have to do that musicals in the late 60s, people were suspicious of. I mean, it's the end of the movie musical era. And
they're sick of it.
Yeah. It doesn't seem authentic that people break out into song.
It's not authentic. I think that's fair to say.
But this is a really interesting drawing, and it gives you a real slice into the world of TV at that time. And so we've now covered theater and TV. So I wanted to look at some film. You know, did he ever do that? And he never did a whole movie season. He did, like I said, he did Academy Award nominees. He might, you know, he sometimes did drawings at the end of, at the end of the year.
And that's what I was just going to say. The Academy Award drawings are, or the Tony Award drawings, those are the end of the season. We're going to open a new season soon, but we want to salute these before they leave or whatever.
And that's what makes these much different is because this is...
This is before their hits, before their flops, before their anything.
No one knows, and including Hirschfeld, who is not seen. I mean, with these films that he drew in the Brute, the first season of Brute Production Films, I doubt he saw any of the films. I'm not sure the films were even made. This really harkens back for him to 40 or almost 50 years earlier when he's essentially working from a title and a synopsis.
I think of the Hallelujah poster.
Which
has nothing to do.
Nothing to do with it, and still a great poster.
If only the movie were as exciting as the poster.
I don't remember when I found this particular piece in Hirschfeld's studio, but it did answer a question for me. In Hirschfeld's studio, he had this sort of, I would say it was lavender plastic hippopotamus that was on top of a file cabinet right by his drawing table. And I just thought, what the hell is that doing here? And I know you could say, well, why didn't you ask Al Hirschfeld? Let me tell you.
Are you really going to ask? Is that the question you're going to use today?
Look, we talked a lot, and we talked about a lot of things. I could have spent days, weeks, maybe years going through his studio and saying, well, so what's this?
Where's this from?
He didn't want to be bothered with things like that. He really didn't care about the past. I was trying to put all the pieces together. And so when I saw this drawing, I'm like, hey, I've seen this hippo before.
That's hilarious.
Do you know who the most dangerous animal is in the world?
The hippo.
Yes.
Yes. They will straight up murder you.
Yeah.
Yes.
My wife always tells me that because I don't believe it.
They kill more people every year than lions. I think that's true.
Well, this is this was an animated film, which is you can see on YouTube. Maybe I should have put a link in there. But I don't think Disney has anything to worry about. and what I love about this is Brute Productions was the, I wouldn't call it a vanity project because some of these films were made and considered quite good, but it was a project by the head of Fabergé, George Barry, who had created a men's fragrance called Brute, which was a huge sensation.
I have heard of that before.
Right. Might even still be made.
It might even still be.
Folks, I'm going to reveal something to you. I do not wear cologne.
You don't wear cologne?
I just smell good naturally.
That's a good thing.
Well, I just wanted to point out in this Brute composite, there's a couple of actors. It's the only drawing of Harry Dean Stanton.
Oh.
We get an Elizabeth Taylor in here, which is sweet. Burl Ives. One of the few drawings of Paul Lynde. I think maybe there's only two other drawings that he's in. One is Bye Bye Birdie, and one is a Joan Rivers film, Rabbit Test. Over on the left-hand side is George Segal and Glenda Jackson, A Touch of Class. And Hirschfeld would actually do a separate drawing that was done, that was used when the film was released. That's the only film out of this whole group that he would do a second drawing of.
Oh, interesting.
And again, there's a drawing of, the film is called Book of Numbers, which has two black performers, Frida Payne, who was just down at the Bucks County Playhouse doing a night of Ella Fitzgerald. But it was, critics thought the film was very interesting because, again, it showed black actors in roles that were not stereotypical black roles. And doesn't seem like a big deal now, but at the time that was a big deal.
Sure.
Okay, then I want to talk about the, you know, he's always doing shows that are opening, and of course, I mean, literally almost all of his newspaper work were shows that had yet to open. You know, but at least he saw those shows.
Right.
This is different because he hadn't seen the shows. In 1977, the Times decides to add a special section to the newspaper on a Sunday that is called The New Season. And it, they did this in part because there was so much great art going on all over the country, but also the arts were some of the biggest advertisers in the newspaper. Theater advertising was huge in the Times, and so was movies. You know, that arts and leisure section was a very profitable section for the paper. And so it was always a matter, one of the New York Times editors who worked on these said it was always a huge discussion on who to include and how to do it and what to do it. But eventually they would give the names to Hirschfeld. They would get him photographs, and he would work from that. And, you know, in the years that when I first saw this, saw these drawings, I was always just so captivated by all the different people. But now as I look at these drawings, I'm really amazed at how they're individual drawings that he's managed to group together, and they don't lose any of their power, and they don't overwhelm each other.
And they often speak to each other.
Right, right. So it's a fully integrated drawing.
Yeah, yeah, it's not just 16 separate drawings that he put together on one board.
Right.
It is one drawing.
And you get everything. I mean, there are very few pieces where you're going to see Paul Cézanne, Zero Mostel, Al Pacino.
Jane Fonda.
Jane Fonda, Bette Midler dancing. Matisse and Neil Young, Richard Pryor and Red Fox and Carol Burnett all together, and Bancroft, Steve McQueen. I mean, it's a pretty amazing piece.
Yeah.
For some of the theater productions, Jason Robards is shown here not in costume. He would eventually do Eugene O'Neill's Touch of the Poet that season, and Hirschfeld did a drawing of that. Anne Bancroft was in a play called Golda, about Golda Meir, the Prime Minister of Israel. And Neil Simon, it's interesting that he gets a portrait here. This is Hirschfeld's first drawing of Neil Simon. But later in the season, when Neil Simon's play opens, Chapter 2, he would do two different drawings that were like bookends.
Right.
One of Neil Simon and his wife at that time, Marcia Mason.
Right.
And then one of Judd Hirsch, and I think it's Anita Gillette, who essentially play them in the play. And so it's really quite interesting. The only sort of false note, I think, in this drawing is his drawing of Bruce Springsteen, who is right next to Neil Young on the left-hand side of the piece. This was...
with the telephone?
No, no. This Neil Young is the long-haired guy.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you said Neil. I was thinking Neil Simon, because all I heard was Neil. I was like, that's Bruce Springsteen?
Just turning David off before he's even finished.
Oh, boy. All right, so, David, I'm going to be honest. You're going to have to tell me who Neil Young is.
Oh, my God. We can't include that in the podcast.
Is he the guy with the little glasses?
No, he's the far left, the guy with the long hair and the beard.
Oh, that's Neil Young?
That's Neil Young.
So that's funny. I always assumed, it's a long story, but I always assumed those guys were like in a rock band.
Well, they are, Neil Young.
I see. So I was right.
Neil Young was performing in, he was touring.
He has beautiful hair.
Who? Bruce Springsteen?
No, Neil Young.
Neil Young. Oh, yeah.
Is he the one with the long hair?
Yes, he's the one with the long hair.
He's got beautiful
His
long
hair was not that long.
That's a shame.
It is a shame. The tour that this was touching on was the Rust Never Sleeps tour, and that was iconic. It was filmed. It was a big stage performance where this is 1977, so Star Wars is just come out, and all the roadies are just dressed as Ewoks.
Okay. From Star Wars.
So it was totally weird.
That is weird.
And there were oversized things. And
so which one's Bruce Springsteen?
Bruce Springsteen is to his right, just above. The bearded guy.
That looks like Santa Claus.
Right. Now, Bruce Springsteen at this time did have a little bit of a beard. And he had a lot more hair than he has now. But I think this is not a great portrait.
Dare
of
I say this is unrecognizable as Bruce Springsteen?
Yes, I will agree
because
with you.
I do know what Bruce Springsteen looks like, and that's not. I would not have guessed that was Bruce.
But
Springsteen.
What is amazing is if you look at Carol Burnett, Richard Pryor, and Red Fox.
Oh, that looks just like
dead on.
That looks just like dead on. The Al Pacino. Yeah.
Yeah.
And you know what? I'm gonna say Jason Robards Jr. looks a little bit like Humphrey Bogart.
Oh, but that's how I drew Jason Robards. Long chin.
Yeah. But I'm just saying, he looks a little bit like...
Yeah. Well, they were both kind of quiet, tough guys.
Yeah, quiet, tough guys.
He would do these new season drawings. He did 10 of them over 12 years. He did do one, for instance, the following year because there was a newspaper strike. He actually did a drawing. We have records that he did a drawing, but we do not have any reproduction of it.
Interesting.
And which is a shame. I'd be interested to see what he focused on. What I found really remarkable, if I said to you, Catherine, what is the first color piece that Hirschfeld did for the newspaper, what would you tell me?
Oh, I would definitely, for the New York Times,
I'm
definitely going to say Beauty and the Beast from 1994.
Yes. Yeah, very classic story that we've told on this podcast. Got the colors wrong. Only people who know the show care about it. But in doing this, I realized that it was not the first. That was the first time it appeared in the paper.
In what we think of when we think of the newspaper.
Yes.
Yes.
But the New York Times Magazine was literally a magazine that came
And was that included in the Sunday Times? So when you bought the Sunday Times, it also came with this, it was like an insert or
yes, it was like an insert. And it was on slick paper.
Right.
Something that was... You know, definitely not the newspaper.
Right.
And he could do color for the cover of a magazine. doing color was easy because the slick paper, the paper and the quality of reproduction was going to be excellent.
It's like a magazine, and he's been doing magazine covers in color for a long time.
The long history of that. What I think is interesting about this piece, New Season 1989, was that it's essentially a line drawing that he's added some color to.
And you think he added this color?
I think he did. They are very Hirschfeld colors.
Yeah.
You know, that blue.
And I'm looking like at that central dancer figure.
Yeah.
You know, that's done by an artist.
Exactly.
He knows what lines to accentuate.
Right.
Where and somebody, just Joe Schmo at the time's adding colors, not going to do it that way.
The pink that you see behind Marlon Brando and in the dancer's
that's a Hirschfeld
cummerbund.
Pink.
That's a Hirschfeld pink.
Yeah, for sure.
So many. I can only imagine that a Hirschfeld, who knew a lot of these people, he knew Tommy Tune, he knew Shirley MacLaine, he knew Jackie Mason, he knew Marlon Brando for that matter. And then he also knew he was good friends with Alexander Calder. And this is his only drawing of Calder. Mm. And I think it's funny that his arm runs right through Hirschfeld's name.
That's funny. And I, of course, love the sea lion as a callback to Sharky, the seal.
Gary Bohan, if you're listening, we're
big sea lion fans over here.
Well, I have noticed that there are have been several animals included.
Actually, have been several. We had just starting with Jack Haley.
Yeah, you had a rabbit, a hippo, and a sea lion.
Yep.
We might have to do an animal show.
Yeah.
Noah's Ark here.
Noah's Ark.
New seasons, there are new seasons of TV, there's new seasons of film, there's new seasons on stage, on dance, all those things. There also happens to be a new season for books.
Hmm.
You know, and in the fall of 1991, there was a new Hirschfeld book coming out called Art and Recollections from 8 Decades. It was actually the first book project that I worked on with Hirschfeld, and it was the most comprehensive collection of his work to date.
Hmm.
And there was a lot of excitement. Hirschfeld had not had a book out at that time for about 10 years, and the one that had been 10 years earlier was just an updated version of Hirschfeld's World.
Gotcha.
Well, no. In 1981, he did Hirschfeld by Hirschfeld, which is
it's a
good book
of
drawings of that period.
Yes, right. That's more focused on 70s.
Art and Recollections is the first real retrospective book. It was a great pleasure to work on that. It was the first time I saw Hirschfeld's scrapbooks, which were quite a revelation to me. I think I told you when we were working on it, when he showed me his scrapbooks from the 1920s, I nearly about lost my mind. And I was so excited. And as we were looking through them, I'm like, oh, we should have more of this, more of this. And Hirschfeld was totally not into it. He couldn't understand why people paid for the drawings. He was embarrassed by them. Not all of them, but a lot of them. And he wanted more recent drawings.
Right.
And I wouldn't say we argued about it. It wasn't my book.
Right.
But I was like, oh, everyone's seen the recent work. They can see it any time, but they never get to see this other work. And when, of course, we got the first galley, I brought it up to him. And I felt it as a personal triumph when we were looking through. We were about halfway through. And Hirschfeld said, should have had more drawings from the 20s.
You should always have more drawings from the 20s.
Yeah. There's so much great work.
Yeah, so much.
And so Art and Recollections was the most comprehensive book to date, superseded now by the Hirschfeld Century.
Of course.
But there was so much interest in this book coming out that Publishers Weekly approached him about doing a drawing. And in this drawing, it's his only drawing of Stephen King, his only drawing of Gloria Steinem. Of course, Shirley MacLaine, we had just seen a drawing or two earlier. And Dan Rather, he drew several times. And they all had books coming out. I think most of them have been forgotten. Stephen King's probably have not.
Mm.
And Hirschfeld Art and Recollections from 8 Decades. Hey, look, if you forgot it, that's on you because it's a great book. And then the final drawing I want to talk about is the last one that he did. the last real new season drawing that he did. And this was in 1995, when it was, it's kind of hard to believe that all these performers were on stage at the same time. Mm. They're really, it's like...
this is heavy hitters.
This is some very heavy hitters. Carol Burnett and Julie Andrews returned to Broadway after a 30-year absence.
That's a long time.
In two shows that were big hits. Mm. Carol Channing returning for the final time in Hello, Dolly.
Wow.
I remember being at Hirschfeld's for lunch the day after the opening, and I said, how was it? He said, as soon as Carol came on stage, you knew you were in safe hands. Aww. And so that was remarkable. Zoe Caldwell in probably her last great role in Masterclass, a really brilliant play that starred a young woman that nobody had ever heard of called Audra McDonald.
Who?
Elizabeth Ashley returning to New York to be in a Tennessee Williams play. She is... become sort of a great Tennessee Williams interpreter, starting back in 1974 when she did Cat on the Hot Tin Roof.
Right.
And really, maybe the greatest actress of all of them, Uta Hagen, just in terms of, at that time, had the longest career. She had been performing since, I think, the late 30s, early 40s.
Wow.
This was her penultimate performance in a play called Mrs. Klein, about a therapist. We have a wonderful spotlight feature on the website on Uta Hagen, right, written by Alan Pally, and I really recommend everybody read that. But again, he has them all here on a stage. It's very classic Hirschfeld.
It is.
And
this is a classic 90s drawing, I think.
Yeah, very much so. It's funny. Carol Burnett, to me, doesn't look like Carol Burnett. But during this run, Hirschfeld, much to his chagrin, there was an article in the New York Times written by Alex Witchell about Hirschfeld during this. And this is an interesting period for Hirschfeld because Dolly had died in September of 1994. And he was in a period of, this was a year later, and he was, you know, New York's most eligible bachelor.
Mm, sure.
But he was missing, you know, he was missing something.
Yeah.
And so it's a, and, but, you know, here he is. All of these women loved Hirschfeld,
mm-hmm.
you know, and they were friends, you know, and he looked forward to seeing them. So Alex Witchell comes up to the house one night. They're having dinner, or maybe they went out to dinner, I don't know. And they get to talking about the season, and Hirschfeld tells her, well, it's very hard sometimes because you take someone like Carol Burnett,
right,
who got plastic surgery, and she just doesn't have the look anymore.
Yeah.
And in fact, she doesn't have any look. There's not there. You know, the personality that people carry on their faces is erased by plastic surgery.
Yeah.
Now, that was a private comment that he never intended to publicize.
In the New York Times.
In the New York Times.
Yeah, and there could have been a little bit more discretion on Alex Mitchell's part, for sure.
Alex,
for
if you're listening, really, did you have to do that? But I will say this. A few weeks later, Hirschfeld and Carol Burnett were at a party together.
Oh, good.
And Carol Burnett came over to him and hugged him and was loved the drawing.
Yeah.
And never once said, what the hell you're talking about.
Right, that's good.
You know.
It is a very flattering drawing of her.
Yes.
She does look very young.
And right.
There you have it.
She looks like what she looked like.
Yeah.
If you look at the drawing of Moon Over Buffalo, you'll also see it's her.
Right.
But it doesn't look like her.
Yeah.
And because when you go back and like that 77 drawing that we were talking about, the new season, she's in there. There's no doubt.
No, it's that Carol looks Burnett. Like Carol Burnett. Yeah.
Okay. And these drawings from Moon Over Buffalo just don't look like it. And it's, you know, it
shows.
And it tells you that he's paying attention.
Yeah, that's true, too. He's not trying to make her who she was. That's
right.
Who she is right now. This is,
I mean, we can look at it. Look, he drew Carol Channing in Hello, Dolly a half dozen times. One would think he would just revert to
right
a drawing he had done before.
Right.
He doesn't do that here.
Yeah. I think it's similar. I think you can argue it's similar.
Well, she's in the same role.
Right. It's the same costume.
But it's not the exact same drawing.
No. She does look a little older here.
Yes.
This looks like an older woman playing. Yeah.
All of them. I mean, he had drawn all of these mm-hmm. performers when they were young. And yeah. here he is drawing them still when they're much older. Some of them would never appear on Broadway again. Mm. And Hirschfeld would go for another 7 years, mm. you know, doing all the things that they had been doing at this time and 90 years earlier. Mm. So that is a few pieces in the show. There's probably another 10 pieces in the show worth looking at. And if we wanted to keep you on here forever, I would go through each one.
And there are a lot of... You cover a lot of ground in this exhibition just by the nature of these drawings. They include a lot of people and a lot of shows.
Right.
And so you learn a lot about a lot.
So it'll keep you interested.
Yeah.
We've got some great merchandise connected to the show on our website.
I love the merchandise for this show.
Yeah.
I think it looks so good.
We work with a great designer, Todd Johnson, who does great work and always makes our merchandise.
This merch, I feel like, stands out. This one's really great.
So whether you want a t-shirt, a tote bag,
I'm partial to the tote bag for this show.
Oh, yeah.
If I'm being honest. I think the tote bag looks
There's even a poster.
There is a poster.
You should check it out if you can. If you have questions, you should go to our website, alhirschfeldfoundation.org. You can access the store there. You can also access about 10,000 drawings there, too. You can look up anything by performer or production, by publication, by date, by genre. You can look up theater seasons or annual. You know, if you want to see all the drawings he did in 1937, you can do that on the website. And then we have, this is our 7th or 8th digital exhibition. We just keep adding them up there. And so there's a lot of great shows to see. So if you haven't been to alhirschfeldfoundation.org recently, do yourself a favor. There will be something that you've never seen before
on there. Absolutely. Yes.
If you have any questions, comments, complaints, you want to know why Catherine doesn't know more than she does, you write to info@alhirschfeldfoundation.org. And we will get that mail. And once I calm Catherine down, we will respond to it.
We're on social media. Facebook, the Al Hirschfeld Foundation. Twitter and Instagram, @AlHirschfeld. You can find the podcast at alhirschfeldfoundation.org/podcasts with an S at the end. S is for?
Season.
Season.
Yeah.
Yeah.
New or otherwise.
New or otherwise. That's right. Old, new. I think that's...
Well, and you could rate and review us.
Oh, yes.
That really helps other people find out about the podcast.
Yep.
It also does a great deal for our self-esteem.
That's right.
We like to think we're speaking to something other than the void. So if you could rate and review us, we would love it and we will read it. And if you get it wrong, we will contact you and let you know.
So you can change it.
No, we won't do that. In any event, thank you for taking the time to spend with us on Hirschfeld's new season. We'll look forward to seeing you when we do.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.